thousand times and more times than I can count. I have called you mine. You have stood by me in my
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. My guest in the second part of our program today is Dr. Shahid Buthar. He is the Executive Director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee and the People's Campaign for the Constitution, which aims to defend civil liberties and our constitutional rights and the rules of law threatened by the war on terror. He received his Doctor of Jurisprudence degree from Stanford Law School and was formerly its chief editor of the Stanford Environmental Law Journal. We're going to talk about, well, it's not just the National Security Agency that's been spying on everyone. Dozens, let me repeat that, dozens of other agencies have been spying on us, are spying on us illegally with virtual impunity. Well, why are they spying on us? Who are they spying on? What do they do with that information? How are they protected? We'll discuss that. We have a lot to talk about. Let us begin. From the University of Exeter Medical School in the United Kingdom, green spaces deliver lasting mental health benefits. This was published in the peer-reviewed journal Environmental Science and Technology. Now, a green space is any environment that includes some natural settings, including bringing in beautiful flora and some form of maybe water wall, something into your home or your work environment. Also, it means being able to spend time in a green space, a city park. That's why in New York City, I love Prospect Park and Center Park and Van Cortlandt Park, because you're in nature. And it depends upon what time of day and which day you go. If you go early enough, it's very quiet, and you get to really feel like you're involved with nature. Well, they're saying that the green spaces in towns and cities could lead to significant and sustained improvement in our mental health. They took a look at a group of people over a five-year period and found that moving to a greener area not only improves your mental health, but also affects any form of, let's say, low energy, mood swings, gets you in a better space mentally. And what I have found is that when people go away for a retreat, if they go to a resort, so you've got noise constantly and kids and everyone, you know, talking on the telephone and music blaring, it's not really a green space, even if it's in a green environment. But going into a natural environment, and suddenly people begin to exhale and breathe and feel relaxed, and they just feel connected. And that's important. So if you've been working in the cities, you haven't got out to the country, do so. Get out as often as you can and spend time, especially those who feel anxious or depressed. Now, historically, people thought if they ate chocolate, they would gain weight. And indeed, it depends upon the type of chocolate you would consume and the amount. Historically, chocolate had some chocolate, but it also had dairy, lots of cream, and sugar. But today, healthy people know that you can buy raw chocolate, or at least healthy chocolate that doesn't have the dairy and has natural sweeteners. So it's not going to add to the body weight. But here's another major story. They found that when they looked at 1,400 adolescents in this one story, and they measured the percentage of body fat, and especially the waist circumference, and then they measured their physical activity, then they found that when they ate a healthy chocolate, they actually lost weight. So the takeaway message is, eating healthy chocolate leads to smaller waists. And it's absolutely great for you. Now, how much chocolate? That's another key factor. Generally, no more than 2 ounces a day is fine. We know that we should be getting vitamin D This is not the time of year to get it. You need about 45 minutes of direct exposure to at least half your body a day to get the amount of vitamin D from the sun. We need magnesium. We generally don't eat magnesium-rich foods or supplement with it. But a new study published in the peer-reviewed Journal of Clinical and Diagnostic Research shows that when people were supplemented with magnesium and vitamin D, manganese, it improved their insulin resistance so that they were less likely to be susceptible to diabetes. Quote, high-risk populations should be screened thoroughly and must be placed on vitamin D supplements. Quote, as per our observation, we hereby advise all type 2 diabetics to take vitamin D and calcium regularly. End quote. That's good. Now, around the world, you'll find that there is an additive to meat. And this additive to meat, called ractopamine, is banned everywhere, but not in the United States. Dr. Joseph Mokola shares these insights with us. He says, meat and beef in particular, quote, is a mainstay of the traditional American dinner. Unfortunately, the vast majority of it is filled with harmful additives of one form or another and is raised in such a way that it contributes to the degeneration of health. This is no minor concern, as most of the animals are fed genetically engineered feed that is loaded with a potent herbicide, glyphosate, that winds up in our bodies. I'm so convinced of the cumulative harms of consuming meat from animals raised in confined animal feeding operations that the only type of meat I recommend eating and the only meat I eat myself is organically raised grass-fed or pasture meats and animal byproducts. This applies to all types of meat, beef, pork, poultry, including turkey. In a recent article published by the Cornucopia Institute, investigative health reporter Martha Rosenberg discusses the questionable yet widespread use of this food additive in American animal farming. According to Rosenberg, the controversial drug is used in as many as 80% of all American pig and cattle operations. It's also used in turkey farming. This ractopamine is a beta agonist drug that increases protein synthesis, thereby making the animal more muscular. This reduces the fat content of the meat and increases the profit per animal. The drug, which is also used in asthma medication, was initially recruited for use in livestock when researchers discovered that it made mice more muscular. Interestingly enough, stubborn weight gain is also a common complaint among asthma patients using Advair, the same type of drug, so much so that the manufacturer has added weight gain to the post-marketing side effects. Other adverse reactions to the drugs include increased heart rate, insomnia, headaches, and tremors. These beta drugs, as a class, have been used in U.S. cattle production since 2003. The drug is administered in the days leading up to slaughter, and as much as 20% of it can remain in the meat you buy. This is disconcerting when you consider that the drug label warns, quote, not for human use. And, quote, individuals with cardiovascular disease should exercise special caution to avoid exposure. Now, while other drugs require a clearance period of around 2 weeks to help ensure the compounds are flushed from the meat prior to slaughter, there is no clearance period for this drug. In an effort to get this dangerous additive out of American meat products, the Center for Food Safety and the Animal Legal Defense Fund recently sued the USDA for withholding records pertaining to its safety. According to Rosenberg, quote, according to the lawsuit, in response to the group's request for information, documenting, analyzing, or otherwise discussing the physiological, psychological, and behavioral effects of the drug, the FDA has only produced 464 pages out of 100,000 pages that exist. Worse, all 464 pages have already been released as part of the FDA's Freedom of Information Act. So the FDA is hiding information. Now, mind you, this drug was banned from food production in almost 160 countries around the world, including those in Europe, mainland China, Russia, and due to its suspected health effects. In 1998, more than 1,700 people reported being poisoned from eating pigs fed the drug. If imported meat is found to contain traces of the drug, it's turned away, and fines and imprisonment result from its use in banned countries. So, Americans are unaware. This is what's getting into your system. And this is being hidden by the FDA, and American media is not looking in on this, and it should. Separately, turmeric and myrrh, M-Y-R-H-H, rarely do you hear people using it, myrrh especially, turmeric more so now. It leads to protecting your body against lead toxicity. This is from the peer-reviewed journal, Basic and Clinical Pharmacology and Toxicology. They found that lead, as we know, is ubiquitous in being a potent neurotoxin, and it's everywhere. It's in the air, and it's in our food. Well, lead toxicity remains a major health concern worldwide. In a study conducted by researchers from Alexandria University in Egypt, they did this laboratory study and found that when the diet was supplemented with turmeric, and the active ingredient in turmeric is curcumin, as well as myrrh, there was a substantial improvement in reducing lead damage. So my suggestion, if you're a person that has been around or is around people who smoke, if you're around paint supplies and or any kind of chemical that you can smell that's in the air, take extra turmeric. You can get myrrh, but that's not as easy. But turmeric is certainly easy to take, generally 1,000 milligrams a day. And myrrh, there are many studies showing it can turn off inflammation, help with menstrual irregularities and pain, help with arthritis, digestive problems, bronchial congestion, skin disorders, even cold sores. And it's really healthy for your liver and your spleen. And of course, curcumin is simply a superstar. Cure, C-U-R, cumin, C-U-M-I-N. And it's, I always like to suggest curcumin separate from turmeric, because at least if you took 1,000 milligrams of curcumin, you're getting 1,000 milligrams of curcumin. If you took 1,000 milligrams of turmeric, you wouldn't know how much curcumin you're getting. You might get 100 milligrams. You're not going to get 1,000 milligrams of curcumin in turmeric because it has so many other ingredients. That's why I always take what's really active in it. And it's great for protecting your body against cancer, cystic fibrosis, Alzheimer's disease, dementia, and any inflammation in your gastrointestinal system. And that's because of the curcuminoids. And they turn off flame and inflammation in the body like nothing else, and it's safe. And finally, there's the big epidemic right now, the non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. It's huge. As many as 40% of adults have it. Now, we used to have no one had it. Well, what made this epidemic happen? Over the last several decades, people have been using artificial sweeteners and high fructose corn syrup. Those are two contributing factors. And we're eating more sugars now than ever before, and the kind of sugars we're eating ravage the liver. So what to do about it? Well, there's some new studies out of Shanghai University using traditional Chinese medicine. And this was a double-blinded clinical multi-center randomized study, and it treated non-alcoholic fatty liver cirrhosis very successfully. What were the ingredients? Well, they found that the leaves of the twisted vine orchid, the roots of the red sage plant, knotweed, K-N-O-T-W-E-E-D, root, and artemisia, and lotus leaves. Again, because you can get these, and you can certainly get these in Chinatown, twisted vine orchid, red sage plant root, knotweed, artemisia, and lotus leaves. So, with as many people suffering, that could make a difference. Now, from our environmental segment today, why is the United States getting in the way of international efforts to make clean water a basic human right? From Shiny Varghese of Alternet, quote, the UN General Assembly's Third Committee adopted a resolution on the, quote, human rights to safe drinking water and sanitation. There, all UN member states agreed that the rights to water and sanitation are derived from the right to an adequate standard of living. As a result, these rights are now implicitly recognized as being part of the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, of the Convention of the Rights of the Child, and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. This means that for the very first time, all UN member states affirm the rights to water and sanitation as legally binding in international law. This is indeed a moment to celebrate. Yet this agreement is marred by the reluctance, you guessed it, of the United States to join all the other nations of the world who are a member of the Universal Agreement on the definition of these rights. And so here's the message. Why would the United States not agree to this? They won't say. They won't give us anything specific on it. It's just like, why don't we sign the treaty that bans personal landmines that cause people to be blown up, mainly civilians, and then we never clean them up once they've been sold to a country that puts them out there, and there are hundreds of millions of them out there. Well, because someone's making a profit, and that someone's made political contributions and has lobbyists, etc. Is it possible that we wouldn't want to have universal rights because we are in league with the World Bank and International Monetary Fund in being able to privatize water and sanitation facilities in other countries? And therefore, if you can't pay for the water or pay for your sewage to be removed, then you don't get it. And that's happening. That is my guess as to why profit, and the profit of some, usurps international rights that everyone else agrees upon. Also, I want to address the issue that everyone has been confronted with, and that is the colder weather that we see. You heard me mention when this storm approached that this was actually due to global warming, that this most severe droughts and the most severe flooding, the hottest days and the coldest day, more earthquakes, more tornadoes, more cyclones, all are due to global warming. And yet when I scan the news channels, I hear Sean Hannity with a meteorologist talking about the nonsense that this is global warming. Well, not true. But let's get to the science of it, and so we can understand. From Carl Gibson, he's telling us about, we've just now experienced a warmer weather in Siberia than in Chicago. By the way, it's also warmer in Anchorage, Alaska than in Atlanta, Georgia. 68% of the continental U.S. was covered in a wave of Arctic temperatures that is normally, you don't get that unless you go somewhere above northern Canada. The official explanation was, we all heard it, right? Polar vortex that's causing the Arctic temperatures to be pushed south. The polar vortex is always present in the Arctic. but strengthens in the winter and grows weaker in the summer. Now, the vortex itself is a natural occurrence, but occasionally the jet stream pushes it further south than normal. And as the Arctic grows warmer at a rapid rate, which it is, we've done many programs here on this, cold snaps, like the one sweeping half the country, will become more frequent. So the answer is the jet stream pushing the polar vortex south in the winter may be more than just a fluke. It's due to climate change. How? Well, it's simple. Old patterns in the jet stream are also responsible for the catastrophic flooding in Pakistan during its already wet monsoon, displacing millions of people and requiring a massive global relief effort. At the same time, the jet stream was also responsible for the unusually dry conditions in Russia, and what happened there? It caused enormous wildfires, the worst in Russian history, to erupt across the country. And that also burned a lot of their grain, which caused them for the first time in decades to stop exporting grain. Now, the northern polar jet stream usually brings extratropical lows and cyclones that make up the bulk of the precipitation in that geographical region of the world and serves as the boundary between colder northern air and hot southern air. When it went suddenly northward, it left those exposed areas unusually hot and dry and prevented necessary rain, making the area ripe for conditions like the wildfires that ravaged the forest near Moscow. And then the jet stream illustrates what happened to the precipitation that missed Russia. After blowing far northward, the rain suddenly headed southward towards Pakistan, causing torrential, devastating flooding. Now, the extreme cold snap covered 68% of the country as a direct result of rapid melting of Arctic ice. Let me repeat that. And for those who are global deniers, write this down and do your homework, and you'll see that what I'm saying is correct. And that everything, I mean everything, that you've heard from Sean Hannity and Glenn Beck and all the others is simply their opinion, which they're entitled to. But they're wrong on the science. The country's cold was due to the rapid melting of the Arctic sheet, making the jet stream more unpredictable. Just last year alone, ice sheets larger than Canada and Texas combined melted, setting an all-time record for the fastest melting polar ice in recorded history. Let me give an example. According to the official measurements on this, from August, it started to melt 35,400 miles a day. That's how much ice melted in the Arctic. Let me just project that. If this pattern continues, sea levels are expected to rise by 23 feet in 6 years. Let me repeat that. If you continue to lose 35,400 miles per day in 6 years, you'd have 23 feet of additional water. And that would cause the sea levels to rise to where Miami would be completely uninhabitable, and that would cause an exodus of millions of climate refugees from coastal cities all over the world. But also, Hurricane Sandy, it was nothing compared to what's coming. It was a little tiny nothing. You can say, but that little tiny nothing cost about $70 billion, caused devastation to people, caused people to lose their lives. Absolutely true. All that suffering was real. But what's going to happen when we get hit with a category of 3, 4, or 5? Then you'll understand what I'm talking about. And that is inevitable. That is absolutely going to happen. So if you think this current cold snap is bad, it will become the new norm, but it won't be for 1 week. It'll be for an entire season. That's right. So you could be having that kind of weather. How are you going to survive? How would you survive if you're in a place where the temperature's at zero below zero every day for months? And that's what we're faced. Now, acknowledging climate change is real and threatening and should not be controversial. even for those scientists funded by the Koch brothers to refute the climate science making the case for man-made climate change, admit that climate change is real and that it's been accelerating since the industrial age. The science shows carbon dioxide stays in the atmosphere and channels heat. That's been around for a while. The only people who disagree with the scientists studying the climate and telling us that we need to pay attention to climate change are the shills paid by the oil industry to spout nonsense on cable news channels. Unfortunately, our government seems to be headed in the exact opposite direction when it comes to climate policy. Like a true capitalist country, the U.S. government is seeking to help corporations enrich short-term profits rather than thinking about the long-term future of global warming. Right now, as we speak, the southern leg of the Keystone XL pipeline is the construction of which President Obama fast-tracked is flowing. So we are on track to see more of this. I'm Gary Nall. We're here to talk about the issues that make a difference in our lives. In 10 minutes now, we'll be talking with my guest that you're not just being spied upon by the National Security Agency, but by dozens of other agencies. And he is Dr. Shahid Buttar, Executive Director for the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. And I will now take on a challenging point to today's New York Times front page, quote, grim sequel to Iraq's war, and also Charlie Rose. Charlie, someone should get him a pillow so he can put those hound dog eyes on the table and not act like he's paying attention. The quality of the guest, all Council on Foreign Relations wannabes are actual people who were there the other night talking about, well, we're seeing this problem because we shouldn't have left and we should have had more control and better people in positions of power. And what do we do? Well, I believe they're all wrong completely, but they control the forums. And as a result, the American people will begin to believe them, even though as of this morning, 44% of the American public now deem themselves independent, 25% Republicans, and the balance are Democrats. But the largest single block of people, voters, are independent, but they're not organized. If they were organized, Jill Stein, Rocky Anderson, others who have true progressive ideals would be in office. So our position is let more people know the truth. Well, let's just take a look at the U.S. imperialism and Iraq's descent into civil war. We'll share insights from Bill Van Aken. It's been a decade after the U.S. military began waging its battles. Now, right now, the news is about Fallujah. Oh, gee whiz. They're taking over Fallujah and also taking over some other cities. And therefore, this is what we're watching. The army of Iraq President Nouri al-Maliki has amassed artillery and tanks on Fallujah's outskirts and has already bombed and shelled civilian neighborhoods, inflicting an unknown number of casualties. Thousands have fled the city in fear for their lives, and the United Nations has warned that the cutoff of water and food and fuel, which was done by Maliki, is creating a humanitarian catastrophe. Maliki has vowed to launch a full-scale assault on the city unless its inhabitants succeed in persuading armed insurgents to surrender. Now think for a moment. What is the likelihood of an unarmed civilian convincing a hardened armed soldier, lay down your weapons, seek peace? It's not going to happen. In April and again in November to December 2004, Fallujah was turned into a killing field by the U.S. occupation. And from the air, it was pummeled by AC-130 Spectre gunships and F-16 fighter jets and Apache attack helicopters. On the ground, a force of over 10,000 U.S. troops, backed by tanks and artillery, was assembled to attack the city. Bombs and missiles, and as we did on this program, exposed in a special investigative report white phosphorus shells. By the way, those shells, give a chemical that was banned under the Geneva Conventions, but that was unleashed against the population. They also targeted hospitals and ambulances. In the end, fully one out of five buildings in the town was destroyed. Two-thirds of what remained were damaged. Hundreds of thousands were turned into homeless refugees. 120 U.S. troops were killed in the two sieges, with no accurate count of how many thousands of Iraqis were killed, but has never been made. Almost all the U.S. media coverage of the current situation in Fallujah, in Ramadi, and elsewhere in Iraq's western Anbar province has begun from the standpoint of what a shock and disappointment these events represent, given the enormous sacrifice made by the U.S. occupation to pacify the area a decade ago. The Iraq War is once again being cast as, you guessed it, just listen to Charles over on Fox, as a humanitarian venture aimed at fighting terrorism and bringing democracy to the Iraqi people. The barbaric attack on Fallujah constituted a war crime. In its aims and scope and ferocity, it was comparable to the kind of collective punishment meted out by the Nazis against resisting populations in occupied Europe. It was emblematic of the criminal character of the entire U.S. war, foisted upon the American people with lies about non-existent weapons of mass destruction and non-existent ties between Saddam Hussein's Baghdad and Al-Qaeda. The war was a premeditated act of aggression launched to further U.S. imperialist aims to assert power over the Middle East and its vast energy reserves. Having failed to secure a guarantee of legal immunity for remaining U.S. troops, Obama ordered the last of them withdrawn from Iraq little more than 2 years ago. Now, the Iraqi people, however, have been left to deal with the bitter legacy of nearly 9 years of U.S. military occupation. Meanwhile, Washington's quest for power in the region has continued, most notably through the war to topple Gaddafi in Libya and its fomenting and support of a war for regime change against the government of Assad in Syria. In Fallujah and Ramadi, the consequences of the crimes of U.S. imperialism, both past and present, have come together in an explosive form. Now, here is where we have to take real careful measure to go on this. The confrontation presented by the corporate media as a struggle against Al-Qaeda terrorists has deep roots in the sectarian divisions that were instigated by the U.S. war and occupation as part of a deliberate divide-and-rule strategy. They succeeded in pitting Iraqi's majority, the Shia population, against the minority, the Sunnis, while the Kurdish minority in the north has been allowed to pursue regional autonomy. While conflicts over borders and rights to oil wealth threaten to erupt into civil war there as well. Now, the government of Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, installed under the U.S. occupation, has pursued an openly sectarian agenda. How? Ruthlessly purging leading Sunni politicians, using the security forces to crack down on the population of Anbar, and branding any protests against these abuses of power as acts of Al-Qaeda terrorism. At the end of December, al-Maliki touched off the present conflict by moving to arrest Ahmad al-Awani, a prominent Sunni member of parliament in Ramadi. His brother was killed and five bodyguards in the process. And then in December, sending a security force to break up a protest that was encamped peacefully, and 17 protesters were killed. So amid seething popular anger and armed groups, including both Al-Qaeda-affiliated Islamic State in Iraq and Levant, and local tribesmen, they seized control of police stations, drove out the security forces, and set up local checkpoints, effectively taking over Fallujah and much of Ramadi. The Obama administration has responded by declaring its full support to Maliki and rushing weapons, including Hellfire missiles, drones, and other equipment, to his military. It is exerting maximum pressure on Congress to end its delay on shipments of Apache attack helicopters and F-16s to the regime. That this weaponry in the hands of a regime that has become even more sectarian and authoritarian may soon be used to massacre civilians, has presented no obstacle to the Obama administration, Charlie Rose's guest, or anyone at Fox. Washington has presented its military aid as an imperative driven by the threat of al-Qaeda, with Secretary John Kerry of State describing those who seize Fallujah as, quote, the most dangerous players in that region. The reality is that such aid is one of the principal means of control and influence that Washington still exerts over Baghdad. And while the troop levels have left, a 1,000-man Office of Security Cooperation, these are armed people at the U.S. Embassy, remains, including both U.S. military personnel and contractors. So we still have thousands of people there. It has managed hundreds of military sales contracts amounting to over $9 billion, that's billion, in just the last 2 years. And most of them are to people who were special, favored ones. As for the supposed threat of al-Qaeda, that is also largely Washington's own making. The threat there has been vastly strengthened by the U.S.-backed war for regime change across the border in Syria, where it has been armed and funded by the U.S. closest allies, particularly Saudi Arabia. The hypocrisy and cynicism of U.S. policy in the region is summed up by the Washington's denunciation of Syria's bombardment of the ISIS forces in Aleppo, even as it rushes more missiles to Iraq so that Maliki can bomb his citizens in Fallujah. Embodied in this glaring contradiction is the dual use that Washington makes of al-Qaeda, employing it as a proxy where it suits its purposes, as in Afghanistan in the 1980s, and more recently in Libya and Syria, and then using it as a boogeyman to justify intervention, as in Afghanistan and Iraq a decade ago, and once again in Iraq today. In conclusion, the prospect that U.S. imperialism may be able to further warm its hands over the fire it has ignited in Fallujah was indicated by the New York Times in an article highlighting, quote, the common enemies shared by Washington and Tehran. Really? I don't think so. I think they've gotten it all wrong and will continue to have it all wrong. Let's now go over and say hello to my guest, who I've given you his background earlier on in the program, Dr. Shahid Puttar. And we're going to talk about, it's not just the National Security Agency. Dozens of other agencies are spying on us. Nice to have you with us today.
Thanks for having me on, Gary. It's always great to talk to you.
Thank you. The Snowden revelations have focused all attention upon the National Security Agency, and consequently the surveillance activities of other federal agencies is being lost in the dialogue and media coverage, even in the progressive left media sources. So I'd like you to review with us the surveillance and monitoring endeavors of some of these other agencies, noting how they differ from the National Security Agency, but also they may complement it. And not surprising, the primary one has been the FBI, which was almost designed for domestic spying and infiltrating organizations and going after anyone who dissents, where that dissent may impact a federal policy or federal agency or a corporation. Now, you sued the FBI in order to gain access to documentation on their secret surveillance programs. We'd like to know what that uncovered about the FBI's unconstitutional policies to infiltrate activist organizations, in particular and without any reasonable suspicion of wrongdoing. Take us on that journey now.
Absolutely, yeah. And you're, it's striking how much heat the NSA is taking in the wake of the Snowden revelations and how little are the other parts of the domestic surveillance apparatus. And the FBI has long been engaged in unconstitutional assaults on the rights of the American people. It went on the last time that the FBI was caught doing this, it had been doing so for 30 years, and the activists who revealed COINTELPRO, the counterintelligence programs, to Congress just revealed themselves, just a few days ago after 45 years of silence. And it's a telling moment, you know, with Martin Luther King Day coming up in a few weeks, how the FBI's assault on the American people never went corrected and continues today. The suit that you mentioned was in 2008, actually. It was some time ago as the Bush administration was leaving office, sued the FBI to gain a copy of its then secret policy. It disclosed the policy, but it ended up redacting, that is to say, blacking out the entire chapter on undercover infiltration, what the FBI calls, quote, undisclosed participation, you know, very innocuous reframing of what it also in COINTELPRO documents described as outright disruption and neutralization. And these are of groups protected by the First Amendment. And this is what prompted the U.S. Senate in 1976 to describe the FBI's domestic intelligence collection programs, and this is also a quote, quote, a sophisticated vigilante operation aimed squarely at suppressing the legitimate exercise of First Amendment rights of speech and association. That's from the Church Committee report in 1976. Long story short, none of those problems were are particularly settled at the moment. Congress did take actions then, and the Attorney General at the time did take actions to try to rein in the FBI. Those protections have been whittled down. And in 2008, as the Bush administration was leaving office, there were two independent hatchets taken to the congressional firewall around the FBI. One of them was the 2008 amendments to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which also let the NSA out of the cage. And that act of Congress is largely responsible for, I should note it was supported by then Senator Obama, that act of Congress is largely responsible for the abuses that the Snowden has been revealing, that and the Patriot Act. And then also later in 2008, then Attorney General Michael Mukasey adjusted the Attorney General's guidelines for FBI operations. And that in particular unleashed a cavalcade of abuses, including pervasive infiltration of First Amendment groups, Occupy sites, for instance, Muslim faith institutions, anti-war and peace groups, groups arrayed against and for the death penalty, repro rights groups, essentially on both sides of the issue. It's an ongoing problem that no one in Congress, at least, is currently looking at.
What are some of the ways and through which departments is the Department of Homeland Security conducting domestic spying? For example, the creation of the biometric surveillance dragnet through the Department of Customs and Border Protection.
That's the biggest one. CBP and ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, are both also involved in spying on the American people. And this is a particularly nefarious effort because it reflects a political stratagem on the part of the agencies, a divide-and-conquer approach, if you will, that uses immigrants as political bait to convince particularly conservatives to accept biometric monitoring that they would never otherwise permit. And so this starts with the Secure Communities Program, and it ends in the Next Generation Initiative. The Secure Communities Program is an ICE collaboration, Immigration Customs Enforcement, with the FBI. And they claim that it's a way to ensure that people who are in the country illegally who have committed crimes are put at the front of the list for deportation. What it actually looks like is running any arrestee, citizen or not, through a biometric screening process, capturing their fingerprints, in some cases getting copies of their irises, you know, like retina scanning, basically. And I gather that there's a pilot project around using voice modulation recordings. And then those records are shared with the FBI. And the point here is to create a national biometric database that's basically a national ID card that is so sophisticated that there's no card required. You can be recognized wherever you are, for instance, by the images on closed-circuit television cameras, surveillance cameras, which are up on the street, or by the images captured by an aerial drone, which, you know, you put that together with facial recognition technology, cross-reference that against the biometric database, and you literally know where everyone in the country is at any given point in time. Here's the kicker, not just online, but in real space, right? You go across the street to visit your friend, you're being tracked, and maybe that doesn't raise an alarm, but what if you're going down the street to the health clinic, right? What if you're going down the street to go to a disreputable house that you might not want others to know about. You can infer a lot about people's behavior from geo-tracking, and that also is a whole other kind of tracking that's emerging. You know, we've talked about the NSA and the dragnet tapping the back end of the internet and the phone system. We've talked about the FBI infiltrating mosques and peace groups and Occupy sites and quite likely potentially Tea Party chapters, though we don't know about that for certain. We've talked about CBP and ICE using immigration deportation as an excuse, a pretext to create a biometric database of all Americans, including citizens. And there's this whole, you know, a whole other further story to explore about state and local police becoming paramilitarized. I'm happy to go into that if you like.
Good. What are some, let me rephrase that. We've known for a while that Homeland Security works closely with state and local enforcement and police departments. But just this last Monday evening, we did a one-hour special with Chase Madar and John Whitehead on the increasing militarization of local police and the creation of what Radley Balko calls the warrior cops. So do you have insights that you could share with us about this relationship between the Department of Homeland Security and local police departments? And what do you believe is the primary motivation for the buildup of the militarizing of the local police forces?
Totally. And I'm so glad you've been covering this, because this is a huge issue in plain sight that I think most Americans don't even realize is happening. You know, there was a point when people might have perceived police as agencies that are here to protect and serve. That stopped being the case some time ago. If you travel around the world, you'll be struck by how lightly armed police are. And I'm gonna actually trace this historically as a narrative, and then I want to particularly sharpen the focus by giving your listeners a sense of what they can do about this. This really started with the crack epidemic, which some journalists, including one who mysteriously found himself dead a few months after writing the story, laid at the feet of the CIA. And there is documentation about the CIA working particularly with Manuel Noriega to import crack into the United States, destabilize urban America's urban areas in the United States. And here's the key: promote street violence that prompted state and local police to gear up, to start procuring sophisticated military equipment to counter particularly drug cartels that apparently were being supplied and enabled by the CIA. Take the CIA out of the equation, and even if you just look at the dynamic following the drug war, a bunch of things happened. One of them, asset forfeiture. Local police started using drug raids as a racket. There was a legal authority that enables the police to basically auction off material that they seize in drug investigations, often even whether or not there is a conviction secured. So even if someone, and there's all kinds of abuses related to this, particularly in Hawaii, I heard a story about police basically raiding a farm where they didn't find anything and still auctioning off, I believe it was a car that they found on the property. And this has become a for-profit racket by police. So what do they put the money into? Just yesterday, in New York City police detectives, a whole series of them, they're being investigated for abusing fraudulent claims in the wake of 9/11 about their health. That's another kind of racket. But what the police agencies were doing in their official capacity was using this money from asset forfeiture in other areas to buy basically military equipment. And not just guns, because, you know, maybe that makes sense, but I mean like surveillance equipment that the military used to deploy in foreign deployment situations. For instance, in Iraq and Afghanistan, because insurgents used improvised electronic devices, military contractors developed for the Pentagon a series of automated license plate scanners that would enable police to basically track the movements of cars, for instance, around Baghdad, to figure out, okay, who's planting the IEDs? We want to see which cars show up in the same neighborhoods where the IEDs get planted, right? Why is that technology being used across the United States by local police departments now? And this is not a hypothetical fear. It has already happened. This is the same thing as local police gaining surveillance drones. That hasn't happened widely yet, but it has happened. There are sheriff's offices flying aerial drones as we speak within the United States with no oversight, with no protections in place, with no Fourth Amendment barriers. And these are local police working through DHS grants to basically get military equipment. You ask me what's the motivation for this. In my mind, it's hard to impute an institutional motivation, but I can lay the dynamic at the feet of something that President Eisenhower described, and that is the military-industrial complex. There is a huge industry in technology and equipment and weapons and whatnot that police use. And when the military-industrial complex turns its eyes on the American people and sees the budgets of the thousands of local jurisdictions as a pot in which to sink its fingers, this is what predictably happens. And there's a reason that the Fourth Amendment has ended up on the cutting room floor, and that's because there is no one minding the store. And that's where I want to focus your listeners, is on the opportunity to mind the store. And the FBI, the NSA, CBP, ICE, the federal agencies are really hard to constrain. People might also be surprised to know that the Postal Service is spying on you, too. But those agencies are really hard to constrain because you have to go through Congress or you have to wait for some federal judge to wake up and smell the coffee and understand that on their watch, America is sliding in a very different direction than the one that the founders intended with respect to personal freedoms. That's not true of your local police. You, anyone, can face down local police because they're answerable to your local city councils. And unlike Congress, they do listen to we the people. Just last summer, the people of New York City wrestled to the ground the world's seventh largest army, the New York City Police Department, and won a groundbreaking set of police accountability restrictions over a mayor's veto. And if that can happen in New York, it can happen anywhere in the United States.
When you look at the larger body politic, the vast majority of politicians on both sides, the vast majority of the American media, including on MSNBC, including some on our sister stations, support whichever party's in office and hence accept that the policies of national surveillance are necessary, even though they may at times be exceeded by prudence. So what is the average American to believe if the people in power, the people like Bill and Hillary Clinton, people like Barack Obama and people on the right as well, when they're told that we are more interested in protecting you and your children, and so these are just necessary rights that you have to understand we must use at this time. How do you confront that and challenge it?
I think there's at least two different angles. The one is to challenge the legitimacy of that dominant duopoly. You started by talking about how whoever is in power gains the benefit of the deference. And you're absolutely right, because we have very small imaginations in the United States, because we have two corporate political parties that are basically in bed with one another, and they differ and they fight to no end over relatively trivial questions, while fundamental questions become the object of consensus. And, you know, the role of corporations in our society, for instance, and their dominance over people and public institutions. That's something on which Democrats and Republicans agree, right? The political process and, you know, the fact that elections are basically fundraising races, that also is something on which they agree. Those are things that can be fixed. Police regulation, or the lack thereof, and the ability of intelligence agencies to disregard constitutional rights, that's something, unfortunately, on which the establishments of both the Democratic and the Republican parties agree. But here's what's interesting now, in the wake of the Snowden leaks, there are substantial pockets in both the Democratic and the Republican Party that are seeing through that ruse. I go back to last August, when there was a vote in the House on a proposal to defund the NSA's domestic dragnet, and it only lost in the House by 7 votes out of 430. And that was in August. You know, this controversy has only built since then. We would win that vote if it happened today, and I fully expect it to happen this spring, and I look forward to the day when the NSA is finally called out for its long-standing abuses. There's a second way to approach this. So one piece of it is saying, okay, don't defer to these abuses only because the guy in the White House looks different.
I'm sorry, but we're running out of time. I appreciate your insights and all your good work, and thank you for bringing on the lawsuits. Even if they didn't supply you with information that was usable, it's important to know that we can sue the FBI and we can sue these agencies and to get information. It lets them know that we are also fighting back. My guest, Dr. Shahid Buttar, that's Buttar. I'm Gary Nolan, and I want to thank you for listening.